from that personality of Godhead, all the universal globes and the universal form with all material elements, qualities and senses are generated. Yet he is aloof from such material manifestations like the sun, which is separate from its rays and heat. Okay, yeah, there, okay, now we got it. Now you can hear me, okay, right? Yes, yes. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, we're
all. That personality of Godhead, all the universal globes and the universal form, with all material elements, qualities, and senses are generated. Yet he is aloof from such material manifestations, like the sun, which is separate from its rays and heat. And so, of course, we're continuing here with Lord Brahma's explanation of cosmology to Narada Muni. And in general, this is second canto. First canto we're describing as a preface. What is the purpose of the book? Under what circumstances is the Bhagavatam being produced? Who is the principal speaker? What are his qualifications? Who's asking the questions? Who's the student? What are his needs and qualifications? You know, circumstances. So all that's very nicely described in the first canto. We meet Sukadeva Goswami, we meet Maharaj Parikshit. The situation is described in general. Kali Yuga is coming. And specifically, the king is being, maldecido, being cursed, bad-mouthed, being cursed by an unqualified Brahmin. So we see all the proper symptoms. And Krishna, along with his dharma and jnana, has left the planet. So we need a new incarnation. So second canto begins then with this perspective, with Sukadeva Goswami actually preaching to Maharaj Parikshit. And of course, first three chapters, he explains Sat, Chit, and Ananda, or Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan, or in Western philosophy, pantheism, mysticism, and monotheism. I'm probably using these terms even. Yeah? But then, so it's everything's there. It's all complete in those first three chapters. But then, of course, Maharaj Parikshit says, very nice, I'm so enlivened, but can you go through it again in more detail? So then he starts explaining. First off, he has one chapter of just asking permission to chant, asking to become qualified to present the Bhagavatam. People ask why he didn't do that in the beginning, but maybe he wanted to go right into the subject matter. But after that, when he's asked again, okay, now let's be a little formal about this. So one whole chapter about glorifying the Supreme Lord and the Bhagavatam. Then he starts by describing the Bhagavatam, the way it was originally spoken by Brahma to Narada. And Narada asks his questions. And Brahma begins to explain the Supreme Lord and who's above him. And, of course, it's the Virat Rup, it's Hiranyagarbha, it's Garbhadakshay Vishnu. You know? And this is Brahma's direct experience of God. The Bhagavatam starts off where the Gita Upanishad finishes, historically and philosophically. So the Bhagavad Gita is a cultivation of the intellect, and Srimad Bhagavatam is a cultivation of the soul. So Bhagavatam, it's not surprising that it starts off with names like Adhokshaja, Achyuta, you know, and things like this, Svaipumsam Paro Dharmo Yato Bhakti Adhokshaja. And Krishna appears, but you know, a lot of it's just talking about this kind of Upanishadic perspective in the beginning. And so Brahma is also talking like this about the Supreme Lord and about Vaikuntha, where there's no fear, where there's no anxiety, where there's no lamentation. You know? So a lot of it is getting out of this material world and going to a higher place. And as we go through Canto 3, we'll progress. 3 and 4 will progress to Krishna's legs. 5 is his waist, 6 is his chest, 7, 8 are his arms, 9 is his throat, and 10, you know, then we'll be able to see Krishna's smiling face. And 5 chapters are his smile, like that. Then 11 is his forehead, and 12 is his crown, like that, you know. So we see the proportion. So here the Lord Brahma is describing to Narada in these verses about this personality of Godhead who who was manifesting all these Virat-rup forms, all these different personalities, great demigods and everything else, who was in the super soul. And we'll see Prabhupada's purport then to this particular verse. Purport. The supreme truth has been ascertained in the previous verse as Purusha, or Purushottama, the supreme person. The absolute person is the Ishvara, or the supreme controller, by his different energies. But he's not. But is he also the Samambonam? He's the Ishvara, the Parameshvara. But is he also the Samambonam? The Ekapad Vibhuti, manifestation of the material energy of the Lord, is just like one of the many mistresses of the Lord, by whom the Lord is not so much attracted, as indicated in the language of the Gita, Bina Prakriti. But the region of the Tripad Vibhuti, being a pure spiritual manifestation of the energy of the Lord, is, so to speak, more attractive to him. The Lord therefore generates the material manifestations by impregnating the material energy. And then, within the manifestation, he expands himself as the gigantic form of the Virat Rup. So, pretty clear cosmology with that. The Vishvarup, as it was shown to Arjuna, is not the original form of the Lord. The original form of the Lord is the transcendental form of Purushottama, or Krishna himself. It is very nicely explained herein that he expands himself just like the sun. Therefore, Krishna, in his supreme personal form, with two hands and a flute, and Prabhupada mentioned this before the same way a couple times like that. And this is kind of really definition of Krishna, two hands and a flute, okay, is bewildering for the impersonalists who can accommodate only the gigantic Vishvarup of the Lord. They should know that the rays of the sun are secondary to the sun. And similarly, the impersonal gigantic form of the Lord is also secondary to the personal form as Purushottama. As Purushottama. So it's quite a potent form. That is Purushottama form. You know, if it manifests everything we're seeing. I'm looking out my window on the second story here in Franklin, Tennessee, and in Tandavika's ashram, and there are trees, big, nice clouds, I have in Hawaii, and the neighbors have dogs, and there are birds, and you know, so many things outside like that, air, wind. You know. But this is all just the manifestation of the Purusha. So how does he do this? The Brahma Samhita 537 confirms this statement as follows. So I can't remember what it is. Anybody remember what 537 is? Ananda chinmaya rasa pratibhavita bis tabirya eva nijarupataya kalabi goloka eva nivasatta kilat mabhuto govindam adi purusham tamaham bhajami. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Govinda, the one who enlivens the senses of everyone by his personal bodily rays, resides in his transcendental abode called Goloka. Yet he is present in every nook and corner of his creation by expansion of happy, happy spiritual rays, equal in power to his personal potency of bliss. My goodness, what a nice translation. Happy spiritual rays. My goodness. Yeah. So then what does that mean? If he's present everywhere, if we see all these nasty things happening. I always remember one striking thing in my life. I was at the Berkeley Temple. You've never been there. Berkeley's right across the bay from San Francisco, so it's all part of the Bay Area. But we moved there because near the university. And the temple was actually six city lots, old Mormon church. So in wintertime, this and that, and the heating, of course, the temple wasn't that good. We're all kind of fighting this way and that way. But it finally was a spring day, so I took off and on the excuse of doing some banking or something, And I was wearing ordinary dress, it was Brahmachari then, whatever. And so going here and there, it was spring, the blossoms were coming out, it was warm and fresh air and birds singing. And I came to one kind of little corner down by the Shattuck Street and down below there, 2 blocks from the temple, 3 blocks. And I was stopped for the light. And all these people were stopped there too in their cars and some convertibles and people. It was Saturday, so people were enjoying, And then one guy pulled up and he had this car that looked like he was driving into the junkyard, for his employer or something, the junkyard owner. And the car was kind of shaking. It was an old convertible. The engine was shaking and shake. And he had like a 5-day growth on his face and beard and was smoking a cigarette halfway hanging out of his mouth, half the ash hanging off. And the car was like a hole in the floor, like some exhaust fumes were coming up from the thing like that. And he was playing this blasting, like, heavy metal radio on top of his thing in the radio. And he had this horrible, his mind was just absorbed in some kind of horrible thoughts about, she said this, well, I said that, and he did that, and I. And it was just so ridiculous because everybody and everything around him was pleasant, But this guy had created his own little, corporal hell like that, carrying it around with him. So all the happy rays are there, but if we're damned and determined, we can turn the happy rays into horrid rays like that. Then Papa goes on, he says, he is therefore simultaneously personal and impersonal by his inconceivable potency. Or he is the one without a second, displaying complete unity in a diversity of material and spiritual manifestations. He is separate from everything, and still nothing is different from him. And that's the end of the purport there. So it's practically speaking, sometimes you can't see the forest because the trees are in your way. My kind of experience is that it seems like the Bhagavatam is kind of written usually for maybe about 5 or 6 verses. It's kind of a collection of verses, maybe like 5 or 6 verses. And not only are the texts kind of focusing on one topic, but also Prabhupada's purports will also carry through with the same kind of like content, like that. And so this is part of this, a general description that Brahma's giving. And if you look at the previous verses, starting 2:16 on up to today's verse, we see the sun illuminates both internally and externally by expanding its radiation. Similarly, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, by expanding his universal form, maintains everything in the creation, both internally and externally. So the universal form includes different psychological archetypal images. Carl Jung probably said of all the Western philosophers, he seemed to have the most sense. So he was saying that there is a subtle psychological world with forms, archetypal forms, the mother, the daughter, the princess, and dreams and stuff. These things are more revealed. They're causal. These subtle archetypal forms, cause things to happen. He said, we're so proud of what's happening up in the attic, in the brain. He said, but that's just responding to what's basically in the heart. His perspective, his cosmology was very good. And we're trying to develop a whole preaching program on this level with the universities and with professors and psychiatrists and stuff and the academic journals of presenting like Prabhupada's philosophy, the Bhagavad philosophy, in terms of Jungian perspectives like that. know? So this is the level that the Virat Roop, being a man, being a woman, being a daughter, being a mother, these are our subtle psychological forms that are more permanent than the gross body. It's just like when you get in a car, you're going to act a certain way. You know, so when you become a mother, most likely at a certain point, there's this thing which descends upon you. You know? Or you become a husband, and at a certain point, as gradually you fit into it, and realize, I'm a husband now. You know? Yeah. And so these are the subtle forms that the Virat Roop is maintaining, like the sun. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is the controller of immortality and fearlessness. And he is transcendental to death and the fruitive actions of the material world. O Narada, O Brahmana, it is therefore difficult to measure the glories of the Supreme Person. Now, actually, back in 2617, which I did before, the Prabhupada introduces in the purport the Ekapad Vibhuti and the Tripad Vibhuti, how 25% of his energies and 75% of his energies. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the basic theme behind all these verses, pretty much. What the Lord, how he's in Vaikuntha, what Vaikuntha is like, what his nature is, how he's controlling this world, how he does it through a general description. More detailed descriptions are there with the elements and the demigods. You start getting into Vastu and things like that, it goes into great detail, you know, how the universal form is expanded. But the basic principles are, you know, he creates the globes and he expands them like his radiation to create the Virat Roop. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is to be known as the supreme reservoir of all material opulences by the 1/4 of his energy in which all the living entities exist. Deathlessness, fearlessness, and freedom from the anxieties of old age and disease exist in the kingdom of God, which is beyond the three higher planetary systems and beyond the material coverings. You know, so I think Prabhupada describes the planetary systems as Marcha, Patala, and Swarga, like that. Yeah, yeah. And so, but above Swarga is a Maharloka, and then Janaloka and Tapaloka. And when there's a dissolution at the end of each day of Brahma, I think, or is it partial dissolution? Maybe it's a Manvantara dissolution. Then the people at Maharloka, that also gets wet. And it's kind of like the flood comes to the point where it's like, you know, 2 feet of water in their house. Well, you can stay in the house when there's 2 feet of water there, but it's not very comfortable. It's up to your knees or something like that, guys. So they get on airplanes and transfer themselves to Janaloka and Tapaloka, like that. So, and beyond that, it's describing. Now, for us, we're so used to these perspectives of the spiritual world, but if you read the Mahabharata and other things like that, when I'm reading it, it's kind of describing that above this world is Swarga, and Goloka is just a part of Swarga. That's what it's described. You know? But when you go there, you get there, you see, oh, we're here now. Oh, well, this Goloka part's even higher. But we were just seeing it from this perspective. So looking at all the Vedic literatures, the Rig Vedas, mantras, and all these things, you know, these people, they don't realize this. So the Purusha Shukta is being described in more detail now. You know, the spiritual world, which consists of 3/4 of the Lord's energy, is situated beyond this material world, and it is especially meant for those who will never be reborn. Others who are attached to family life and do not strictly follow celibacy vows must live within the 3 material worlds. And so that purported, remembering the Prabhupada just, you know, is so strict on this point about celibacy, you know, and that's basically, that's the whole process, you know, the whole process is to be taken us down to earth, you know, and usually that's the idea. The Prabhupada just makes it very clear again and again that female form is designed to bring the male form down, like that, you know. And so everybody has a certain kind of body. You know, somebody is a Brahmana, somebody is Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. Yeah, Brahmanas are better than Kshatriyas. And it goes on and on like this. It's in the hierarchy. So they're always, and on the other hand, you can say that children are meant to bring women down like that. That's what children are created for, from this perspective. From a material perspective, is that children are meant to ground women. Women are meant to ground men. You know? And then women are meant to raise up children. Men are meant to raise up women. The king is meant to raise up the men. The brahmanas are meant to raise up the royalty. Yeah. And it goes on like that. Devas, demigods. And so this is one yoga, one way to do it, one ladder. But it's basically like taking the stairs. I want to go to the 35th story, the top story of the building. Okay, there's this thing, that thing. And it will get you there. And sometimes it's a good process. You know? But of course, we're recommending what? The sublime process that you get in the elevator and push the button which says 35. And maybe if you're a little bit hung up, you stop off on 26 or 30, you know, or 30 to look at different things, you know, ladies' clothing or men's sporting goods, you know. Yeah, okay. Well, yeah. And maybe I won't like it when I get to Goloka. You know, maybe there won't be any nice clothes in Goloka. There'll be no parties. Maybe there won't be any games in Goloka. Yeah? So it's being described like this with all the different levels. And being free from sex. Of course, Prabhupada also says, when I say men, I mean women for men. And for a woman, the man is also the source of problems like that. Yeah? So another big topic. Okay. So, but the thing is, we have to become celibate. And we have to maintain it. Except, of course, when the process is to serve Krishna, like Devaki and Vasudeva or something like that, Bhaktivinoda Thakur and his wife, to have Bhaktisiddhanta for his son. And of course, we know, understand that's transcendental. Yeah. From that personality, what is it? By his energies, the all-pervading personality of Godhead is thus comprehensively the master in the activities of controlling and in devotional service. He is the ultimate master of both nescience and factual knowledge in all situations. So yesterday's class. From that personality of Godhead, all the universal globes and the universal form with all material elements, qualities, and senses are generated. He is aloof from such material manifestations like the sun, which is separate from its rays and heat. So I think it's pretty thorough. You know, you contemplate it. You can read the book, okay, that's karma, karma yoga. You can understand it logically, that's jnana yoga. And it's the beginning of dhyana, first level of meditation, smaranam, is actually this logical understanding. And of course, as you develop a more and more sophisticated logic, analytical geometry, arithmetic, thinking processes, your contemplation becomes more profound. At a certain point, the dhyana, you know, and then after that becomes actually bhakti. You can read the book, you can understand it logically, you can contemplate it, and then finally you can actually appreciate it, you know, love it. Yeah. And so going through this every single time, it seems we're getting pretty good, you know, appreciation. Like I say, you begin to appreciate how the beautiful trees outside with the wind making them dance and stuff with the clouds behind. Yeah, this is Krishna. Yeah. And also appreciating that the air here is this continuous ozone, you know, here, smell like that, although we're kind of in the country. And so appreciating all this contamination is also appreciating this is being produced by the living entities and their relation with the Bharat Rup and how is it going on. Then once we do that, we begin to see through it all. And we begin to see there has to be a person behind all this. And what's he like? You know, are his happy rays extended everywhere? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sunshine on my shoulders makes me happy. And you get all these pantheistic, you know, people and their songs and so on. You know? Then beyond that, okay, he's in my heart. He's in everybody's heart. So you begin to see the form of the transcendence. The form of the transcendence. And then finally you begin to have a relationship like that. So this is the section here, this Bharat Rupa explanation, and then the sunshine is Krishna is the sunshine. Then after that, a whole new section will start, maybe again about four or five verses, where Lord Brahma we'll talk about how to have a relationship with this Paramatma Virat Rupa manifestation. And he'll talk about then offering different ingredients, flowers, fruits, grains, spices, you know, taking all these. And basically he's talking about these different sacrifices according to different time, place, circumstance, describing the Vedas, which are all meant for pleasing the satisfaction of the Lord, like that, and where the elements come from. You know? So this chapter, I would call it Purusha Shukta confirmed. So, Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. So any kind of questions or comments about these verses? A very, of course, sophisticated section like that.
Yes, Maharaj, I have a question.
Acha.
I've never heard it described how you had explained that Goloka is simply a another realm of Swarga, a higher realm of Swarga.
Yeah, that's what I was. Of course, no, that's what I was saying. I see it appears that way. You know, if you read the if you're reading the translation of the Mahabharata, I was reading, and it may have been Kamala Subramanian's, you know, translation a long time ago, and it was describing, you know, the Mahabharata is so big, you know, that almost nobody gives the whole thing. They extract this, they extract that, they summarize this, they summarize that. I was told by one scholar that just before the battle starts, there's what would take something like about 3 pages where one rishi describes all the weapons and just gives the names of all the weapons like that one after another. So probably there's not a, you know, maybe the Ganguly or something, probably not a single Mahabharata that we're going to come across is going to do that. They're just going to say that. And then this sage described many, many weapons. You know? So at least the one I was reading was describing how I think you just heard everybody else was seeing it. You know, it's just like right now. What do we see? You know, Gokula is a part of Uttar Pradesh. Uttar Pradesh is a part of India, right? You know, but that's actually not a fact. If you go to Uttar Pradesh and you go to Mathura Mandal, then you discover that it's actually not a part of it at all. You know, it's something much bigger being projected, you know, onto something smaller. It's just like saying the sun is in the glass of water. You know? Yeah, the sun is in the glass of water, but then you start, you know, looking at it as a reflection, you see, oh, the sun is much bigger. You know? So same way, people in the Mahabharata and what people are accustomed to, I think from the Vedic perspective, is they think like that. You know, if they think, for example, they think that Krishna is, what is it, the 9th incarnation of Vishnu or whatever it is. They think that he's the Hindu love god, you know, like that. Yeah, but that's just like a little materialistic idea. So that's the only point I was making, that the Bhagavatam here is really starting off with this Bharat Rupa and Mahavishnu level, you know, to get us on a broader perspective. And we'll go through 9 cantos and we'll actually come to seeing how everything is just an expansion of Goloka.
Thank you. Good explanation.
Maharaj, this is a wonderful class. You make things so clear and you bring them down to earth. I really appreciate that. I was just going to bring up a couple of points and ask for your comments, please. I really enjoyed your relating each canto to a different part of the transcendental body of the Lord, number one. And number two, and it's not visible on the screen now, but I believe in the purport, Prabhupada said that the Ekad Vibhuti is like a mistress that the Lord has lost interest in. I really like that.
Yeah. Just like one of the many mistresses of the Lord by whom the Lord is not so much attracted. Yeah. I mean, I found this nice picture on the internet. It shows Garuda with, I guess it's Shri and Boo. And Vishnu has his arms around their waists like that. They're sitting there with one leg up on Garuda. Yeah. It's an interesting point because now actually we're on the Bhakti Bhai Baba program out of San Jose there. We're on the last year, we're on the 5th canto, we just started it. So we're on the chapter of what is it? Rishabhdev's appearance and Rishabhdev's what call it? Rishabhdev's activities and disappearance like that. I think it's 4, 5, and 6. And so it says that even though it says his body was completely transcendental, his body wasn't like an incarnation or anything else, you know, and that people were, you know, urinating on him and everything else, but his excrement smelled like this and that, you know, and finally he gave his body up. So very, very interesting phrase. That the translation, I think it says that His body, actually, I could probably pull it up here.
Okay. Okay.
So these are, this is our chapter study guide reproduced. Module 1, Story of Priyavrata, Agnidra, and Rishabhdev. This week we're doing chapters 5 and 6, Rishabhdev's teachings and activities. And they have a verse to memorize, which I suggest that we don't memorize. Memorize something else. Yeah. And come down here. Okay. Yeah, so in chapter 6, text number 7, it says, actually Lord Rishabhdev had no material body, but due to yoga maya, he considered his body material, and therefore because he played like an ordinary human being, and then we comment, ak, gronk, brak, humph, this seems so dangerous. Isn't this exactly the argument that the Mayavadis use? We are all God, but we have illusioned ourselves so that we can enjoy our material lila. So it was a very, very nice, stimulating discussion because it brings out this point. Does Rishabhdev actually forget that his body is spiritual and then he enjoys playing like this? How much does Yoga Maya cover? And also, it says he's not being covered by Mahamaya. He says he had no material body, but he considered his body material due to yoga maya. Yeah. So we had a nice discussion with my study partner, and tomorrow we'll have our general meeting like that. Because it says that Krishna enjoys sometimes. You know, somebody's moving papers or something in the background there. Yeah. Says that the example, of course, is Kubja. You know, Kubja is that Shakti that Krishna associates with sometimes. And one example I understand is it's like somebody who makes this deal with God that he'll only eat prasadam. He won't eat bhoga, but he wants good prasadam, like that. Krishna, I promise to not eat anything but prasadam, but I want some good prasadam. You know? Yeah. And so he wants to enjoy with Krishna. Kubja wanted to enjoy herself with Krishna, but nobody else. And Suparnaka, Ravana's sister, she also wanted to enjoy, but with Ram. And so she became Kubja, according to one description like that, in the next lifetime. Yeah. So the other example is Yoga Maya. She produces different demons and stuff like that, you know, to attempt to attract the living entities. So as I understand it, the Yagasura demon was a first time model that she never done an Agasura like that before. So she got it together and made up this Agasura demon. And when Krishna saw it, he was just amazed. It's like you give a boy a new toy. He knows it's a toy, but oh my God, what a toy. You know, let me just get out in the street and show my friends, you know. So when Krishna saw the Agasura demon, he was just amazed. Wow, what a demon! And she was really, you know, feeling very happy and proud, you know, that he liked my demon. You know, he liked my demon. You know, so that's the way that actually there is some that Krishna really does. Probably says that Krishna does enjoy his pastimes in the material world. You know, but from our point of view, it's a different thing like that. You know. So, but he doesn't hang around all the time, and yoga and Mahamaya is very interesting because she can appreciate this, you know. She can appreciate that, you know, Krishna not consorting with her all the time. So I don't know. Is another interesting point. Is she Parvati, and does Krishna associate with Parvati sometimes? And what does Lord Shiva think about this? We got many more cantos, I guess, before we go resolve all these problems. And the pace you're going is going to take, I think, 20 years before you get to the 10th canto. If you stick with this. So, any other complaints or questions here?
Maharaj,
I want to bring.
Go ahead.
I wanted to bring up a point and sort of get you to maybe speak on this a little bit. It's something that you spoke about, and also Vidagda spoke very nicely on this point yesterday, and that is the subject of celibacy, and how that is that's sort of the main thing that keeps us bound up is the sexuality. And so it's easy to grasp and understand refraining from gross sex life. But it's also important that we understand that celibacy means not just refraining from gross sex, but there's many subtle levels. In the seventh canto, Prahlad says, "Yanmai tunari grihime tu sukami tuchcham." So he says, "Yanmai tunari." So the suffix adi means sex, gross sex, and all the subtleties, talking about, thinking about, etc. So as a sannyasi, you must have some very nice realizations and thoughts in that regard of all these other levels of celibacy that we want to try to embrace for our spiritual growth. Could you speak on that?
I would say I have a different... Prabhupada says, I remember, you certain things, certain little phrases and stuff, and you collect them, and how many can you... Prabhupada says, no disciple can take everything the spiritual master is offering. But I always remember that Prabhupada says, there is no difference between the grihastha fully engaged in spiritual life and the man in the renounced order of life. But because of formal austerities, the sannyasi is given more formal respect. Like when I'm giving a class in San Jose, and Vaisheshika comes in, he took second initiation, the same letter I took first initiation, And of course, in so many ways, obvious that he's far superior to me in so many ways, and book distribution and everything else. He's taller than I am. so many things, But so when he comes in, I'm sitting there on the little diocese, maybe 40 people in a Wednesday night class. And so, I just stopped the class. Forget it. He's going to have a nice seat for him. And it's because of his back, there's one kind of cushion he uses and stuff. And properly seated. But he refuses to sit on on something as elevated as I am, because I'm a sannyasi and everything else. But it's very nice. The whole thing of proportion is there, that he's obviously a better devotee and stuff, but because of formality, it's just to his credit that he then maintains the social order. That because of the formality, then we give more formal respect to the sannyasi, and so on. So I would say that there's no reason why a grihastha can't have as much, more, in some ways more realization about the subtle sex and everything else because of a situation, or a grihastha couple, and they're realizing how they have to. One time it's described that grihastha ashram means to go to be fasting and dieting and go and sit in front of your refrigerator with the door open. That's what grihastha ashram means. Whereas sannyasi or brahmachari doesn't go into the kitchen, They don't do it. But grihastha ashram, you've got in some ways have more control, more realization, about these things. That's a fact. I'm in sannyas ashram because it's kind of my karma, Not because I'm a very, very advanced devotee. And I have the natural faults of a sannyasi. A lady may have some natural faults. The emotions are strong, this and that. Also be a good thing, because you can deal with people on an emotional level, But I don't have that. So my nature is to renounce everything. My first thing is whenever any problem comes along, just as soon as it gets a little too problematic on that level, I just renounce it. I walk away, And that's not good always. So many times it's not good. You should stay there and help resolve the problem, yukta vairagya. So that's my perspective on sex. It is a fact, though, that the ashram is nice, I remember one time I went to India, and at that time, not even ISKCON devotees, or to speak of Indian ladies, would ever approach me to talk to me alone. And by alone, I mean even in a public place. Like after a class, I give a class, and then one boy, maybe 20 or something, 18, 19, he came up with an older lady, and he said, "Maharaj, Maharaj, my mother has a question," Now, I could have said to him, what is her question? And she was standing a little bit back, you know. And so I could have done the whole thing through him or in his presence. You know, I could have talked to her like that and so on, you know. But that was the standard. And then I was just going on. And actually, after that, maybe a month in India or something like that, I was leaving. And suddenly it hit me like that, that for an entire month I hadn't had any kind of... In the West, of course, after classes, some lady comes up and talks to you, and everybody else is kind of shuffling here and there, getting ready for Guru Puja or something. You know, nobody thinks anything about it, you know. But in India, it wouldn't happen. And actually, I noticed it did make a whole much more kind of like sattvic environment. In a sattvic environment, then it's easy to see your subtle attachments. And the passion and ignorance which sometimes comes into the Grihastha Ashram, then it's a little more difficult just to see the things that are there. But in the very sattvic environment, which is still material, then you can see these attachments. And also, too, because your senses, you do become more in the mode of goodness, your senses and everything else does become more sensitive. And so you can actually do the same thing, too, see the stimulation and stuff, which normally you wouldn't see. So it's kind of like, the other point is that the ojas is kind of like a combination of water and fire and stuff like that, mucus. Because it describes it, probably translates the ojas as semina. But it's circulating in the marrow and it's in both male and female bodies, like that. But basically the idea is at the time of when male and female bodies reach puberty, female body, it starts flowing down and out on a regular basis. There's almost no control unless you're, you know, Vedavati or Swayam Prabha. So it's flowing down and out, you know. And then in the male body, if you're trained to follow celibacy and you have the environment, then it can rise up, you know, gradually, until finally it hits the cerebral cortex. And then by, you know, 13 years old, 14 years old, you start developing very, very fine cerebral cortex and fine nadis. And you can, you know, you can use those to store things. And, you know, so you develop very, very fine analytical abilities. Whereas in female body, then usually you develop, you know, fine sensual perception and the emotional the sensitivity that goes with it, like that and so on. One time Lord Shiva said that his ojas, semina, had been dislodged from his heart by seeing Parvati trying to stimulate him to produce offspring and stuff, you know. And so therefore, you know, somebody had, at that point they didn't want him to produce producers. Somebody had to accommodate his powerful semina, ojas. Who's going to do this? You know, nobody can handle it. But it was very interesting because normally he didn't even let it go down from his heart. And you can actually consciously see this when you get agitated, either male or female body. You see some ridiculous stimulus. You know, our environment is so stimulating. Billboards, movies, everything. It's just, you know, designed, even the way, you know, our social culture, so many times it stimulates the ojas, the prana, to descend from the heart to the stomach, then on down to the genitals. And then there's a reaction. You can feel the tactile energy going there, and you can feel the physiological reaction. And you actually can feel it. The pressure is too much. You don't control it. It doesn't just stretch it. It actually tears the fabric, you know. And then even though there may be no gross loss of fluid in either body, you know, still you can feel this subtle tearing in the subtle physical body, the prana body, like that. And it may take you a day or two for it to heal, you know, and come back up. And so there's a tremendous drain on our energy by the environment around it. It keeps us all dull and stupid, and we have to take in motivation from these very low levels. We have to eat, you know, garbanzo beans boiled with onions, you know, to have strength. You got to take your energy into this low level, you know. So that's kind of like some of my realizations. Yeah.
Thank you. Very interesting. It's nice.
Yeah. I remember Madan Mohan. I'll tell you one thing. Madan Mohan, I've got to pay my copyrights, share my royalties. When we were up in Grass Valley, he talked about this, that you see Maya. And so if you say, oh, it looks like Maya. Well, let me kind of tune it in there. Yeah, it's Maya. Pretty good figure. No, but it's Maya. Make sure though. So after about, you know, 4 or 5 minutes of tuning in and making sure what kind of Maya it is, everything else, you say, well, I better reject this, you know. So the Buddhists have a phrase, A good horse runs, my God, somebody's crashing your microphone there. A good horse runs even at the shadow of a whip. So I started applying that, and Madan Mohan's point here, I noticed it, yeah. And so you start, it's a word, it's like satisfying to look at Maya and reject her. And when we just reject her just because of the fragrance and everything else, it leaves kind of like, oh, yeah. And so I remember certain times I would just do that, and I'm just very strict about it. And I could see how much my mind was attracted just to the subtle thing of taking a look and then rejecting it. Yeah. Thank you, Madan Mohan.
I don't remember that exactly, Maharaj, but it sounds like something I might have said. At this point, I've changed it a little bit, that you just say Hare Krishna whenever you see something like that. It kind of like, that's the whole program. And then you can be chanting all the time.
Yeah, in Vrindavan, only Krishna and Balaram kill demons. Hare Krishna, Hare Rama, Radharani, pray to Krishna and Rama to protect us. Maharaj,
can I get in for a minute?
2 minutes.
Okay. It was interesting, the quote towards the end, where the impersonalist is saying, we're all God, but we have illusioned ourselves so we can enjoy our material lila. And yesterday I was... something similar was being said, you know, I said, how can they say they're God if they're having to follow some process to shake the illusion, you know, shake the ignorance, and that would make ignorance more powerful than God. So anyway, this reminds me of modern atheists like Richard Dawkins, who have an agenda to spread their idea through, and though they pose to be practical and objective, when you really examine these people, you will find that they are fundamentally dishonest. You know, and I met a woman in the market here, and her and this other lady were distributing these Mayavadi books, and the conversation kind of devolved down to a question where I was like, I was so shocked at her mentality that I just made a ridiculous question for her. I said, then you are responsible for everything that we see here and all the way up to the, you know, the universes? And she had no problem saying yes.
Yes.
You know? And so, you know, Prabhupada introduced us to the idea, you can wake a sleeping man, but you can't wake a man that's pretending to be asleep.
Yeah.
So I think we have to come to the stage where we understand the difference between, you know, a genuinely confused person who doesn't have an agenda and those that are fundamentally dishonest, that yeah, will never
accept. Innocent and the demoniac, huh? The innocent and the demoniac.
Or the inimical, right. It's like the Madhyam stage where you avoid inimical people that have an agenda. They'll never be defeated. You know, they'll just create false arguments and distractions. That's all they do.
Forever.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. And we experienced it. We like to fight with them, no? We get into this thing, oh, I'm going to defeat this Maya body.
Right.
And we get entangled into the whole thing of wanting to become a greater God than the other God. Yeah. One Gurukul teacher, his devotees, many, many, many years, he says, the kids are growing up, and at home, they're like little gods, you know, a little god at home. But when they go to school, a school for the first day, it's such a shock. If you can remember this, I remember it. But there's so many other little gods there and stuff, and I'm no longer the god. Oh, that was a trauma, you know, being away from my mother, being put in the care of, like, a school teacher and stuff like that and so on. Yeah. So many people are at the same level. Maybe even the 50-year or 55-year-old body, but they're having to deal with this trauma, you know, of accepting there's some higher authority than me, you know, and stuff. Wow,
right.
And denying it. Wow. That's why the Bhagavatam is so many examples of preaching, no? I mean, it's Taittiriya Vaisheshika, you should go through and just, for his Bhakti Bhai Baba thing, and just write, you know, explain all the different preaching strategies that people adopt. Because there's so many different kinds of people that are, and some people are 50% sincere, you know? And so then you can deal with them the difference than somebody who's 80% sincere and somebody who's only 20% sincere, you know? Like, what was Duryodhana? Did Duryodhana have any sincerity at all? Some examples of him actually manifesting some character or sincerity.
He made Karna king on the spot.
About how he cared for the citizens, at least in his own thinking,
yeah.
Because he was a kshatriya.
But that was Karna was for his own benefit, though, no, huh? In some ways.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, but maybe it wasn't only that. Like the thing I remember is the very, very end. He's dying with a broken back, and everybody's abandoned. They're all dead. They're all gone. And he's hating everything. And then somebody comes and sits down, and he doesn't even look at them, but he's feeling some comfort. So finally, he looks, and it's the son of Devaki. You know, and he says, "Okay." He says, "Everybody says you're the Paramatma. You know everything. You're Dharma personified. What did I do wrong?" You know, and Krishna says, "Well, you know, you tried to poison Bhima." He said, "Yeah, but he was always breaking our heads and tossing us out." Okay. He tried to burn them to death and said, "Well, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen." So he had an excuse for everything, you know. And then finally, when it came down to Draupadi and trying to desnude this 16-year-old girl in front of all these nobilities, you know, he tried to weasel out of that one in his own mind, but in the end, he had to admit to himself. He admitted to himself that was too much. A man does not do that kind of thing. So I would say that ultimately, the reason Draupadi in the end had to go through that was to save Duryodhana, to squeeze some kind of innocence out of him. And in the end, even he expressed some kind of sincerity and some innocence in his character that Krishna was able to get to, you know, by doing all this, you know. And so, you know, it's different, you know. Anyway, I can't arrange the battle of Kurukshetra for preaching, so I try and in a more broad distinction about who to preach to and stuff.
Yeah.
We've
just the last line. We've seen over the years as devotees, if somebody's committed like a born again Christian, it's a waste of time. You know, to try to talk to such a person. And so I think the committed atheists that are enlivened by that argument, they're also a waste of time.
Yeah. Yeah. To me, I like it because it brings this point up, because Krishna does enjoy the material world, you know, and he does let himself go, you know, to certain degrees and stuff like that. So it's interesting how, because it's yoga maya from his point of view. Mahamaya never overcomes him. I've heard Bhadravardhan. Remember Bhadravardhan? He was this tall, skinny brahmachari guy who was in San Francisco. You know him? He's a 10,000-year-old Tibetan. But anyway, he became a PhD later on, left. I wonder where he is. So anyway, he's very nice. My close associates. He made this point that, and it's exactly what Krishna makes in the Krishna book now, I'm thinking about it. He says that. He says that Subhadra, if you're good, she's yoga maya. But if you're bad, she's mahamaya. Okay. You know, he tells you when you appear, because materialists will worship you by this name, that name, that name, Bhadrakali, and so on. You know? So that's the point, that you know, we're looking at this and it's mahamaya, and somebody else is looking at it as yoga maya. But subtly, because then mahamaya is Parvati, it's that whole question like that. And I think she is. That's her job. She's Parvati. You know? And so with the devotee, she's a great friend, but with the demon, she's killing him. That's the weird thing, is that she's a material nature, but her job is to kill the demons. Oh, my goodness. Okay, I guess I should go now. We have an incredible day today on Friday. We have all these internet classes, and we're also trying to get ready for... I'll tell you more information later on, but in July, we're going to have this symposium on education for North America. And Hawaii is still a part of North America. The Japanese are probably trying to take over still. Okay, so thank you all very much. Hare Krishna.
Jai, thank you so much, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. Dandavat.
Jai, thank you. Hare Krishna.
Thank you, Mahesh.